The Castle by Franz Kafka, continued. Disc 3. Dealing directly with the authorities wasn't all that difficult, for no matter how well organized they were, they only had to defend distant and invisible causes on behalf of remote and invisible gentlemen, whereas he, Kay, was fighting for something vitally close, for himself, and what's more, of his own free will. Initially, at least, for he was the assailant, and he was not struggling for himself on his own. There were also other forces, which he knew nothing of, but could believe in because of the measures adopted by the authorities. By mostly obliging him from the start in some of the more trivial matters, and no more had been at stake until now, the authorities were depriving him not only of the chance to gain a few easy little victories, but also of the corresponding satisfaction and the resulting well-founded confidence for other, greater battles. Instead, they let Kay wander about as he wished, even if only in the village, spoiling and weakening him, barred all fighting here, and dispatched him to this extra-official, completely unclear, dull and strange life. If this went on, if he weren't always on guard, he might one day, despite the friendly attitude of the authorities, despite his meticulous fulfilment of his exaggeratedly light official duties, be deceived by the favour seemingly granted him, and lead the rest of his life so imprudently that he would fall to pieces, and the authorities, gentle and friendly as ever, would have to come, as though against their will, but actually at the behest of some official ordinance of which he knew nothing, in order to clear him out of the way. And what did that actually amount to here, the other part of his life? Nowhere else had Kay ever seen one's official position and one's life so intertwined as they were here, so intertwined that it sometimes seemed as though office and life had switched places. How great, say, was the power Clam wielded over Kay's service, which, up to now, had been no more than a formality, compared with the power Clam possessed in actual fact in Kay's bedroom. That's why a slightly more frivolous approach, a certain easing of tension, was appropriate only when dealing directly with the authorities, whereas otherwise you always had to exercise great caution and look about on all sides before each step you took. Kay initially found his view of the local authorities very much confirmed at the chairman's. A friendly, fat, clean-shaven man, the chairman was ill. He had a severe attack of gout and received Kay in bed. "So you must be our surveyor," he said, intending to sit up and greet Kay, but he couldn't manage it, and, pointing apologetically to his legs, threw himself back down on the pillows. A woman, quite still, almost shadow-like in the dimly lit room, whose small curtained windows made it even darker, brought Kay a chair and put it by the bed.
Sit down, surveyor," said the chairman. "And tell me what you want."
Kay read Clam's letter aloud, and then added a few comments. Again he thought he felt the extraordinary ease of dealing with the authorities. They bore the whole burden, quite literally. You could leave everything up to them and remain free and untouched yourself. As though sensing this in his own way, the chairman stirred uneasily in his bed. Finally he said,
"Surveyor, as you've noticed, I knew about the entire affair. The reason I haven't seen to it yet is, first, I have been ill, and then you took so long to come I thought you had given up the affair. But now that you're so kind as to call on me, I must, of course, let you know the entire unpleasant truth. You were, as you say, taken on as a surveyor, but we don't need a surveyor. There wouldn't be the least bit of work for a person like that. The boundaries of our small holdings have been marked out, everything has been duly registered, the properties themselves rarely change hands, and whatever small boundary disputes arise, we settle ourselves. So why should we have any need for a surveyor?"
Kay, despite having never really thought about this before, was convinced, deep down, that he had been expecting some such communication. For that very reason, he was immediately able to say, "I find this most surprising. It upsets all my plans. I can only hope there's been a misunderstanding."
"Unfortunately not," said the chairman. "It is as I say."
"But how is that possible?" cried Kay. "After all, I didn't set out on this endless journey only to be sent back now."
"Well, that is a different matter," said the chairman, "and one that's not for me to decide, though I can explain how this misunderstanding was possible. In an administration as large as the Count's, it can happen at some point that one department issues an order, another a second, neither department knows of the other, the higher-ranking control agency is indeed extremely precise, but by nature it intervenes too late, and so a little confusion can nonetheless arise. Of course, this happens only in the tiniest matters such as yours. In a large affair I have never heard of an error, but even the small cases are often quite embarrassing. Now, as for your case, without turning this into an official secret, I'm simply not enough of an official for that, I'm only a peasant, and that's good enough for me, I want to give you a frank description of what happened. A long time ago, I had only been chairman for a few months, a decree came, I cannot recall from which department, stating in the categorical manner so typical of the gentleman up there that a surveyor would be summoned and instructing the local council to be ready with all the plans and records needed for his work. This decree obviously cannot have been about you, for that was many years ago, and I wouldn't even have thought of it if I weren't ill in bed with all the time in the world to think about the silliest matters. Mitzi, he said, suddenly interrupting his account, to the woman who was still flitting about the room on some incomprehensible errand. Please look in the cabinet. Perhaps you'll find the decree. You see, he told Kay by way of explanation, it's from the early days when I still kept everything. The woman opened the cabinet right away. Kay and the chairman watched. The cabinet was crammed with papers. Once it was open, two large packs of files tied together in a bundle like firewood came rolling out. The woman started and jumped aside. Down below, it should be down below, said the chairman, directing from his bed. After obediently gathering the files in both arms so as to reach the papers underneath, the woman threw out the entire contents of the cabinet. The papers already covered half the room. We've certainly accomplished a great deal, said the chairman, nodding, and that's only a small part of it. I stored the bulk of it in the barn, but most of it got lost. Who could keep all that together? But there's still a great deal left in the barn. You think you can find the decree? He said, turning again to his wife. You should look for a file with the word surveyor underlined in blue.
It's too dark here. I'll get a candle, said the woman, walking on the papers as she went to the door.
My wife, said the chairman, she's such a great help in carrying out this difficult official work, which is only part-time. I have one other aide, the teacher, for written work, but it's still impossible to finish everything. A large portion never gets done, but we have put that away in the cabinet there. And he pointed to another cabinet. And especially now that I am ill, everything is quite out of hand, he said, lying down again, tired yet proud. Well, Kay said, the woman had come back with the candle and was on her knees looking for the decree. Couldn't I help your wife look? The chairman shook his head and smiled. As I said, I'm not keeping official secrets from you, but to let you look through the files would be going too far.
There was now silence in the room. All one could hear was the rustling of papers. Perhaps the chairman was dozing off. A light knock at the door made Kay turn around. The assistants, of course. Still, they had picked up some manners, didn't barge into the room right away, but whispered first through the slightly open door.
It's too cold outside.
Who is it? Asked the chairman, starting.
Only my assistants, said Kay. I'm not sure where I should get them to wait for me. It's too cold outside, and they're a nuisance here.
Oh, they won't bother me, said the chairman agreeably. Let them in. Incidentally, I know them, old acquaintances.
But they do bother me, said Kay, frankly, letting his eyes wander from the assistants to the chairman and back again to the assistants. He found the smiles of all three indistinguishable.
Well, now that you're here, he added as a test, stay and help the chairman's wife look for a file with the word surveyor underlined in blue. The chairman did not object to this. What Kay was not permitted, the assistants were now being permitted. They immediately threw themselves on the papers, but instead of searching, they merely rummaged about in the pile, and each time one of them spelled out the words on a file, the other tore the file from his hand. But the woman was still kneeling in front of the empty cabinet. She seemed to have stopped looking altogether. The candle was now some distance from her.
"The assistants," said the chairman with a self-satisfied smile, as though he himself had arranged all this without anybody else's knowledge. "So they bother you? But they're your own assistants."
"No," said Kay coolly. "They simply ran up to me here."
"Why ran up?" he said. "You must mean were assigned."
"Fine, were assigned then," said Kay. "But they could just as easily have fallen like snowflakes, given how little thought went into assigning them."
"Well, nothing ever happens here without due thought," said the chairman, who even forgot about the pain in his foot and sat up.
"Nothing," said Kay, "and what about my being summoned here?"
"Well, even the decision to summon you was carefully considered," said the chairman. "But a few minor details introduced some confusion. I can prove this through the files."
"Well, the files won't be found," said Kay.
"Won't be found?" cried the chairman. "Mitzi, do hurry a bit with your search. I can first tell you the story, though, even without the files. We responded to the decree I mentioned earlier by pointing out gratefully that we don't need a surveyor. However, this reply seems never to have reached the first department, which I shall call A, and went by error to another department, B. So Department A was left without an answer, and unfortunately B didn't receive our entire answer, either because the contents of the file never left us, or because the file itself got lost on the way. Though certainly not in the department itself, I'll vouch for that.
All that came to Department B in any case was the file folder, which simply had on it a note saying that the enclosed, though in reality unfortunately missing, file dealt with the summoning of a surveyor. Meanwhile, Department A was waiting for our answer. They had preliminary notes on the affair, but as often happens, and this is quite understandable and even justifiable given the precision with which such matters must be handled, the designated official was expecting that we would answer and he would then summon a surveyor, or, if need be, engage us in further correspondence about the matter. As a result, he paid no attention to his preliminary notes and the entire matter slipped his mind. In Department B, the folder reached a functionary famous for his conscientiousness. Sordini is his name, an Italian. Even an insider such as myself cannot understand how a man of his abilities can be kept in what is virtually the lowest position of all. Now, this Sordini did, of course, return the empty folder to us for completion. But by now, many months, if not years, had passed since we had received the message from Department A, understandably, for when, as is the rule, a file heads the right way, it arrives at its department in one day at the latest, and is dealt with that same day. But should it ever lose its way, the excellence of the organization is such that the file must zealously seek the wrong way, for otherwise it won't find it, and then it does indeed take a long time. So when we got Sordini's memorandum, we had only the vaguest memories of the affair. There were only two of us then for all this work, Mitzi and I. The teacher hadn't been assigned yet, and we kept copies only in the most important cases. In short, we could answer only vaguely to the effect that we knew of no such summons and that there was no need for a surveyor here. But, said the chairman, interrupting himself as if he had gone too far in his eagerness to tell the story, or as if it were at least possible that he had gone too far, does the story bore you? No, said Kay. It amuses me. At that, the chairman said, I am not telling you this for your amusement. It amuses me, said Kay, only because it gives me some insight into the ridiculous tangle that may, under certain circumstances, determine a person's life. Well, you still haven't gained any insight, the chairman said gravely, and so I can go on. Well, of course, our answer couldn't satisfy a Sordini. I admire the man, even though he torments me. You see, he distrusts everyone. Even, for instance, on countless occasions he finds that someone is a most trustworthy person, on the very next occasion he mistrusts him, as if he didn't know him, or, more precisely, as if he knew him to be a rascal. I think that is right. That's how an official must behave. Unfortunately, by nature, I cannot follow that precept myself. You can see how I'm telling all this openly to you, a stranger. I simply cannot help it. But Sordini immediately distrusted our answer. A lengthy correspondence came about. Sordini asked why I had suddenly realized that a surveyor shouldn't be summoned. With the help of Mitzi's excellent memory, I answered that the initial proposal had come from his own office. That a different office had been involved, we had, of course, long since forgotten. And then Sordini said, why was I mentioning this official memorandum only now? I, because I had only just recalled it. Sordini, that was quite odd. I, it wasn't odd in a long-drawn-out affair like this. Sordini, it certainly was odd, for the memorandum that I recalled did not exist. Aye, of course it didn't exist, since the whole file had been lost. Sordini, still, there should be a preliminary note concerning that first memorandum, but there was none. Then I faltered, for I was not so daring as to claim, or even to think, that Sordini's department had made a mistake. Surveyor, in your thoughts you may be reproaching Sordini for not having been prompted by my claim to make inquiries about the matter in other departments. But that would have been wrong, and I want this man cleared of all blame, even in your thoughts. One of the operating principles of the authorities is that the possibility of error is simply not taken into account. This principle is justified by the excellence of the entire organization, and is also necessary if matters are to be discharged with the utmost rapidity. So Sordini couldn't inquire in other departments. Besides, those departments wouldn't have answered, since they would have noticed right away that he was investigating the possibility of an error. "'Chairman, allow me to interrupt you with a question,' said Kay. "'Didn't you mention a control agency? "'As you describe it, the organization is such that the very thought "'that the control agency might fail to materialize "'is enough to make one ill.' "'You're very severe,' said the chairman. "'But multiply your severity by 1,000, "'and it will still be as nothing "'compared with the severity that the authorities show toward themselves. "'Only a total stranger could ask such a question. "'Are there control agencies?' There are only control agencies. Of course, they aren't meant to find errors, in the vulgar sense of that term, since no errors occur. And even if an error does occur, as in your case, who can finally say that it is an error? Well, that would be something completely new, cried Kay. It's very old as far as I'm concerned, said the chairman. Not altogether unlike you, I'm convinced that there has been an error, that Sordini became seriously ill out of despair over this, and that the first control agencies, to which we owe the discovery of the source of the error, also recognize the error here. But who can claim that the second control agencies will judge likewise, and the third, and so on?
Perhaps, said Kay, but I would rather not start interfering with considerations like that yet, and also this is the first I have heard of these control agencies, and so, naturally, I can't understand them yet. Still, I think two things must be distinguished here. First, what happens inside the offices, which can then be officially interpreted this way or that, and second, the actual person, me, who stands outside those offices and is threatened by those offices with a restriction that would be so senseless that I still cannot believe in the gravity of the danger.
Chairman, as regards the former, the matters you have just spoken of with such admirably uncommon expertise are probably valid, but I should also like to hear a few words about me.
Well, I'm getting there, said the chairman. But you wouldn't be able to understand it if I didn't say a few other things first. Even my mentioning of the control agencies just now was premature. So I'm going back to the differences with Sordini. As I said, my defences gradually weakened. But if Sordini has even the slightest advantage over a person, then he has already won, for this sharpens his attention, energy, and wits, and for those under attack he is a terrible sight, but a splendid one for the enemies of the person under attack. Only because I experienced the latter in other cases can I speak of him as I do. And by the way, I have never yet succeeded in setting eyes on him. He cannot come down, he's overburdened with work. I was once told that the walls in his room are hidden behind columns of large bundles of files piled on top of one another. Those are only the files Sordini is working on just then, and since files are constantly being taken from and added to the bundles, all this at great speed, the stacks are constantly falling down, and it's precisely those endless thuds in rapid succession that have come to seem typical of Sordini's study. Well, Sordini is indeed a worker, and pays as much attention to the smallest case as to the biggest.
Chairman, said Kay, you're always calling my case one of the smallest, and yet it has kept many officials very busy, and, even if it was perhaps quite small at first, it has, through the zeal of officials of the same type as Mr. Sordini, become a big case. Unfortunately, and very much against my will, for my ambition is not to have big stacks of files concerning me piling up and then crashing down, but to work quietly as a little surveyor at his little drawing board.
Oh, no, said the chairman. It isn't a big case. You have no cause for complaint in that respect. It's one of the smallest of the small cases.
It's not the amount of work that determines the rank of a case. You're still far from an understanding of the authorities if you believe that. But even if the amount of work were decisive, your case would still be one of the least significant. The ordinary cases, that is, those without so-called errors, create a far greater quantity of admittedly much more productive work. Incidentally, you still have no idea of the actual work caused by your case, so I want to tell you about that first. Initially, Sordini left me out of it, but his officials came. Every day formal hearings were held at the Gentleman's Inn with respected members of the community. Most stood by me, but a few became suspicious. Land surveying is an issue that deeply affects peasants. They scented some sort of secret deals and injustice. They also found a leader, and Sordini had to conclude from their presentations that if I had raised the matter at the local council, not everybody would have opposed the summoning of a surveyor. And so this perfectly obvious point, namely that there's no need for a surveyor, was at the very least made to seem problematic. In all this, a certain Brunswick played a prominent role. You probably don't know him. Perhaps he isn't bad, just stupid and given to fantasy. He's the brother-in-law of Lazarman.
Of the master tanner? Asked Kay, and he described the man with the full beard whom he had seen at Lazarman's.
Yes, that's he, said the chairman.
I know his wife, too, Kay said, just on an off chance.
Well, that's possible, the chairman said, and he fell silent.
She's beautiful, said Kay, though rather pale and sickly. She probably comes from the castle? This was said half as a question. The chairman glanced at the clock, poured medicine into a spoon, and swallowed it quickly.
So you are merely acquainted with the office furnishings at the castle? Kay asked rudely.
Yes, said the chairman, with an ironic and yet grateful smile. They're the most important thing about it. As for Brunswick, if we could expel him from the community, virtually everyone would be happy, Lazarman not least of all. But Brunswick gained some influence at that time. He's not a speaker, but a shouter, and that's good enough for some. And so I was forced to lay the matter before the council, which, by the way, was Brunswick's only success at first, since the council naturally decided by a large majority to have nothing to do with the surveyor.
That, too, was years ago, but the matter still hasn't died down, partly through the conscientiousness of Sordini, who tried to probe the motives of both majority and opposition by means of the most meticulous inquiries, partly through the stupidity and ambition of Brunswick, who has various personal contacts with the authorities that he was able to bring into play thanks to his boundless imagination. Sordini, though, didn't let himself be duped by Brunswick. How could Brunswick dupe Sordini? But precisely so as not to be duped, he had to set up new inquiries. But before they had ended, Brunswick had already thought up something else. He's actually quite quick. That's one form his stupidity takes. And now I'm going to talk about a special feature of our official apparatus. In keeping with its precision, it is extremely sensitive. When a matter has been deliberated on at great length, it can happen, even before the deliberations have ended, that suddenly, like lightning in some unforeseeable place, which cannot be located later on, a directive is issued that usually justly but nonetheless arbitrarily brings the matter to a close. It's as if the official apparatus could no longer bear the tension and irritation stemming year in, year out, from the same, perhaps inherently trivial affair, and had all by itself, without help from the officials, made the decision. Of course, there was no miracle, and some official or other certainly wrote the directive or reached an unwritten decision. At any rate, one cannot determine from down here, or indeed even from the administrative offices, which official reached the decision in this case and on what grounds. This is only determined much later by the control agencies, and so we never get to hear any more about it. And anyhow, by then, the matter would scarcely interest anybody. Now, as I said, it's precisely these decisions that are mostly excellent. The only disturbing thing is that one only gets to hear about them when it's too late, for one is still passionately discussing a matter that has long since been resolved. I don't know whether such a decision was reached in your case. There is evidence both for and against. But if that had happened, they would have sent for you, and you would have set off on that long journey, which would have taken time, while Sordini would have been working on the same case to the point of exhaustion, Brunswick would have kept up his intrigues, and I would have been tormented by both. I'm only suggesting this as a possibility, but the following I know for sure. A control agency discovered, meanwhile, that many years previously, Department A had sent the local council an inquiry concerning a surveyor, but still hadn't received a reply. Recently, they sent me an inquiry that actually resolved the entire matter. Department A was satisfied with my reply, stating that no surveyor was needed. Sordini had to acknowledge that he wasn't responsible for the case and that he had, though of course through no fault of his own, gone to a great deal of useless, nerve-wracking trouble. If new work hadn't come pouring in, as usual, from all sides, and if your case hadn't been only a very minor case, the most minor of minor cases, one could almost say, we would all have breathed sighs of relief. Even Sordini would, I believe, have done so. Brunswick was the only one who muttered about it, but that was quite ridiculous. And just imagine how disappointed I was, surveyor, after the happy conclusion of the entire affair, and a great deal of time has gone by since then, when suddenly you appear and it seems as if everything is about to begin all over again. That I want to prevent this from happening, in so far as it lies in my power, is something you'll surely understand, won't you?
Certainly, said Kay.
But I have an even better understanding of the dreadful mistreatment that I, and perhaps the laws as well, are being subjected to here. I, for one, know how to combat this.
How do you plan to do so? Asked the chairman.
I cannot give that away, said Kay.
I don't want to intrude, said the chairman, but keep in mind that you have in me, I don't want to say a friend, since we're actually total strangers, a business acquaintance, as it were. The only thing I shall not permit is your being taken on as a surveyor, but otherwise you can always approach me with confidence, though only within the limits of my power, which isn't great.
You're always saying that I am going to be taken on as surveyor, said Kay, but I have already been taken on. Here's Clam's letter.
Clam's letter, said the chairman. Well, it is valuable and even venerable because of Clam's signature, which appears to be genuine, but otherwise, still, I wouldn't risk saying anything about it on my own. Mitzi, he called, adding, but what are you doing?
The assistants, who had been left unobserved for such a long time, and Mitzi, had evidently not found the file they were looking for, and had then tried to lock everything up in the cabinet again. But the jumble of files was so large that they hadn't succeeded. Then it had surely been the assistants who had hit upon the idea that they were now carrying out. They had put the cabinet on the floor, stuffed all the files in, then sat down with Mitzi on the cabinet door, and were now trying to force it down slowly.
"So the file hasn't been found," said the chairman. "A pity. But of course you already know the story. We no longer need the file. Besides, it'll turn up. It must be at the teacher's. He has many more files. But come here with the candle, Mitzi, so you can read the letter with me." Mitzi came over. She looked even more insignificant and grey, sitting on the edge of the bed and clasping her strong and vigorous husband, who had his arm around her. All one could make out in the candlelight was her small face, with its distinct stern lines, softened only by the decay of age. She had barely looked at the letter when she clasped her hands lightly. "From Clam," she said. They read the letter together, whispering to each other from time to time, and finally, as the assistants shouted, "Hurrah!" for they had finally pushed the cabinet door shut, and Mitzi watched them in silent gratitude, the chairman said, "Mitzi agrees with me completely, and now I can probably risk saying what I think. This letter isn't an official letter, but rather a private one. That is already clearly apparent from the heading, 'My Dear Sir.' Besides, it doesn't say a word about your having been taken on as surveyor. Rather, it refers only in general terms to the lordly services, and even then the phrasing isn't binding, since you have merely been taken on as you know. In other words, the burden of proving that you've been taken on rests with you. Lastly, you're referred exclusively to me, the chairman, who, as your immediate superior, will provide you with all further particulars, and that has, of course, already been largely taken care of. All this is utterly clear to anyone who is capable of reading official letters, and therefore better still at reading unofficial ones. That you, a stranger, cannot make this out doesn't surprise me. All in all, the letter merely means that Clam intends to look after you personally should you be accepted into the lordly services." "Chairman," said Kay, "you interpret the letter so well that all that's finally left is a signature on a blank sheet of paper. Can't you see how you're disparaging the name of Clam, which you pretend to respect?" "Well, that is a misunderstanding," said the chairman. "The significance of the letter hasn't escaped me, nor am I disparaging it with my interpretation, quite the contrary. A private letter from Clam has far greater significance than would an official letter, but not the significance you give it." "You know Schwarzer?" asked Kay. "No," said the chairman. "Perhaps you do, Mitzi." "You don't either?" "No, we don't know him." "Well, that's odd," said Kay. "He is the son of a sub-steward." "Dear surveyor," said the chairman, "how am I supposed to know all the sons of all the sub-stewards?" "Fine," said Kay. "Then you have to believe me when I say it's he. The day I came, I had an annoying encounter with this Schwarzer. He then made inquiries by telephone, spoke to a sub-steward called Fritz, and was told that they had taken me on as surveyor. How do you explain that, Chairman?"
"Well, quite simple," said the chairman. "You haven't ever really come into contact with our authorities. All those contacts are merely apparent, but in your case, because of your ignorance of the situation here, you think they're real. As for the telephone, look, in my own house, though I certainly deal often enough with the authorities, there's no telephone. At inns and in places like that it may serve a useful purpose, along the lines, say, of an automated phonograph, but that's all. Have you ever telephoned here?" "You have? Well then, perhaps you can understand me. At the castle, the telephone seems to work extremely well. I've been told the telephones up there are in constant use, which, of course, greatly speeds up the work. Here, on our local telephones, we hear that constant telephoning as a murmuring and singing. You must have heard it, too. Well, this murmuring and singing is the only true and reliable thing that the local telephones convey to us. Everything else is deceptive. There is no separate telephone connection to the castle, and no switchboard to forward our calls. When anyone here calls the castle, all the telephones in the lowest level departments ring, or all would ring if the ringing mechanism on nearly all of them were not, and I know this for certain, disconnected. Now and then, though, an overtired official needs some diversion, especially late in the evening or at night, and turns on the ringing mechanism. Then we get an answer, though an answer that's no more than a joke. That's certainly quite understandable, for who can claim to have the right, simply because of some petty personal concerns, to ring during the most important work conducted, as always, at a furious pace? Nor can I understand how even a stranger can believe that if he calls Sordini, for instance, it really is Sordini who answers. Quite the contrary, it's probably a lowly filing clerk from an entirely different department. But it can also happen, if only at the most auspicious moment, that someone telephones the lowly filing clerk and Sordini himself answers. Then, of course, it's best to run from the telephone before hearing a sound. "But that isn't how I saw it," said Kay. "I couldn't have known the details, but I had little confidence in those telephone conversations, and always knew that the only things that are of any real significance are those one discovers or accomplishes at the castle itself." "No," said the chairman, seizing one phrase, "those telephone answers are of real significance. How could it be otherwise? How could the information supplied by a castle official be meaningless? I said so already in relation to Clam's letter. All these statements have no official meaning.
If you attach official meaning to them, you're quite mistaken, though their private meaning as expressions of friendship or hostility is very great, usually greater than any official meaning could ever be.
Fine, said Kay. If all that is indeed so, then I must have plenty of good friends at the castle.
On closer inspection, the idea the department had many years ago of possibly sending for a surveyor at some point was a friendly gesture toward me, and from then on there was one such gesture after the other, until it came to a bad end with my being enticed here and threatened with being thrown out.
There is some truth in your view, said the chairman. You're right that the castle's statements shouldn't be taken literally. Still, caution is always necessary, not only here, and the more important the statement, the greater the need for caution. But what you then say about your being enticed here I find incomprehensible. If you had paid closer attention to my observations, you would know that the question of your being summoned here is far too difficult to be dealt with in one little conversation.
Well then, said Kay, the only possible conclusion is that everything is very unclear and insoluble except for my being thrown out.
Who would dare to throw you out, Surveyor? Said the chairman. It's precisely the lack of clarity in the preliminary questions that guarantees you the most courteous treatment, only it seems that you are too sensitive. Nobody is keeping you here, but that still doesn't mean you're being thrown out.
Oh, Chairman, said Kay, now it's once again you who is seeing certain matters far too clearly. I shall list for you certain things that keep me here. The sacrifices I had to make to get away from home, the long, difficult journey, the reasonable hopes I held out for myself of being taken on here, my complete lack of fortune, the impossibility of finding suitable work at home, and finally, my fiancée, who comes from here.
"Oh, Frida," said the chairman, not at all surprised.
"I know. But Frida would follow you anywhere.
As for the rest, though, certain considerations must indeed be taken into account, and I shall report this to the castle. If a decision comes, or if it's necessary to question you again, I shall send for you. Do you approve of this?"
"No, absolutely not," said Kay. "What I want from the castle is not charity, but my rights."
"Mitzi," said the chairman to his wife, who still sat pressed up against him, dreamily playing with Clam's letter, which she had turned into a little boat. Startled, Kay now took it away from her. "Mitzi, my leg is beginning to hurt again. We'll have to change the compress."
Kay rose.
"Then I shall take my leave," he said.
"Yes,"
said Mitzi, who was already preparing some ointment.
"Besides, it's too draughty."
Kay turned around. Upon hearing Kay's comment, the assistants had, in their usual misplaced zeal, immediately opened both door panels. Obliged to shield the sick room from the powerful blast of cold air, Kay was only able to bow quickly to the chairman. Then, dragging the assistants along, he ran from the room, quickly closing the door.
Chapter 6. Second Conversation with the Landlady.
Waiting for him in front of the inn was the landlord. Without being asked, he wouldn't have dared to speak, so Kay asked what he wanted.
"Have you found new housing?" the landlord asked, looking at the ground. "You're asking on your wife's instructions," said Kay. "You're probably quite dependent on her."
"No," said the landlord. "I'm not asking on her instructions. But she's very upset and unhappy because of you, cannot work, is always lying in bed, sighing and complaining."
"Should I go to her?" asked Kay.
"Well, please do," said the landlord. "I tried to get hold of you at the chairman's. I listened at the door, but the two of you were talking. I didn't want to interrupt. Besides, I was worried because of my wife. Ran back, but she wouldn't let me in, so I had no choice but to wait for you."
"Then come quickly," said Kay. "I'll soon calm her down."
"If only that were possible," said the landlord.
They went through the bright kitchen, where three or four maids, scattered about doing odd chores, literally froze at the sight of Kay. Even in the kitchen, one could already hear the landlady sighing. She lay in a windowless alcove separated from the kitchen by a light wooden partition. There was room only for a large double bed and a wardrobe. The bed was so positioned that one could see the whole kitchen and supervise the work from it. But from here in the kitchen, one could barely see anything in the alcove. It was quite dark in there, only the white and red bedclothes shimmered through a little. Not until one had gone in and one's eyes had adjusted could one make out the details.
"So you've finally come,"
the landlady said feebly. She lay stretched out on her back, evidently had trouble breathing, and had thrown back the down quilt. In bed she looked much younger than in her usual clothes, but the little nightcap of delicate lacework that she wore, though too small and swaying back and forth on her hair, made the decay of her face seem pitiable.
"How could I have come?" said Kay gently. "After all, you never sent for me."
"You shouldn't have kept me waiting so long," said the landlady with an invalid stubbornness. "Sit down," she said, pointing to the edge of the bed. "But the rest of you go away." Besides the assistants, the maids too had meanwhile pushed their way in. "I should go away too, Gardena," said the landlord. Kay was hearing the woman's name for the first time. "Of course," she said slowly, and as though she had other thoughts on her mind, she added absent-mindedly, "Why should you of all people stay?" Yet once all of them had withdrawn to the kitchen, this time even the assistants followed immediately, but then they were after a maid, Gardena showed enough presence of mind to realize one could hear everything that was said here from the kitchen, for the alcove had no door, and so she ordered them all to leave the kitchen. This happened at once. "Please, surveyor," said Gardena, "right inside the wardrobe there's a shawl. Hand it to me. I want to pull it up over me. I cannot stand the down quilt. It's so hard to breathe." And once Kay had given her the shawl, she said, "Look, it's a beautiful shawl, isn't it?" To Kay it seemed like an ordinary woolen shawl. He felt it once again merely to be obliging, but said nothing. "Yes, it's a beautiful shawl," Gardena said, and covered herself up with it. She was now lying there quietly. All her ailments seemed to have vanished. She even remembered her hair, which was dishevelled from lying in bed, sat up a moment and adjusted her hairdo slightly round her nightcap. She had a full head of hair. Kay became impatient and said, "Landlady, you made someone ask me whether I had found new housing." "I made someone ask you?" the landlady said. "No, that's wrong. Your husband asked me about it just now." "I can believe that," said the landlady. "I had a fight with him. When I didn't want you here, he kept you here. Now that I'm happy you're living here, he drives you away. He's always doing this kind of thing." "So," said Kay, "you've changed your opinion of me that much? In an hour or two?"
"I haven't changed my opinion," the landlady said, more feebly again. "Give me your hand. That's it. And now promise me you'll be absolutely honest, which is exactly how I'll be with you."
"Fine," said Kay. "But who goes first?"
"Me," said the landlady.
It didn't seem as though she were trying to be accommodating toward Kay, but rather as though she were eager to speak first. She pulled a photograph from under the pillow and handed it to Kay.
"Look at this picture," she asked.
So as to see better, Kay took one step back into the kitchen, but even there it wasn't easy to make anything out in the picture, for it was faded with age, broken in several places, crushed and stained. "It's not in very good shape," said Kay.
"Alas, alas," said the landlady, "that's what happens when one keeps carrying it around for years. But if you look at it closely, you'll surely be able to make everything out. Besides, I can help you. Tell me, what do you see? I like hearing things about the picture. So what is it?"
"A young man," said Kay.
"Right," said the landlady. "And what's he doing?"
"He's lying down, I think, on a board, stretching and yawning." The landlady laughed.
"That's quite wrong," she said.
"But here's the board, and he's lying here," said Kay, insisting on his point of view.
"But take a closer look," said the landlady in annoyance. "Now then, is he really lying there?"
"No," Kay now said. "He isn't lying there. He's hovering. And now I can see that it's not a board, but most likely a rope. And the young man is doing a high jump."
"That's it," said the landlady, delighted. "He's jumping. That's how the official messengers practice." "Well, I knew you would make it out. Can you see his face, too?"
"I can't see much of his face," said Kay. "He's obviously making quite an effort. His mouth is open, his eyes are screwed up, and his hair is blowing about."
"Very good," said the landlady appreciatively. "That's all anybody who hasn't seen him in person could possibly make out. But he was a handsome youth. I caught only one fleeting glimpse of him, and yet I shall never forget him."
"So who was it?" asked Kay.
"The messenger," said the landlady. "The messenger Clam first summoned me with."
Kay found it impossible to listen closely. He was distracted by rattling glass. He immediately found the cause of the disturbance. The assistants were standing outside in the courtyard, hopping from one foot to the other in the snow. They acted as if they were happy to see Kay again. Out of happiness, they pointed him out to each other by tapping on the kitchen window. At a threatening gesture from Kay, they stopped right away and each tried to push the other back. But one of them slipped past the other, and now they were back at the window again. Kay rushed into the alcove where the assistants couldn't see him, and he didn't have to see them. But there, too, the faint and as if imploring rattle of the window panes pursued him for quite a while. "Those assistants again," he said to the landlady, so as to excuse himself, pointing out the window. But she was paying no attention to him. She had taken the picture from him, looked at it, smoothed it out, and pushed it back under the pillow. Her movements had become slower, not out of weariness, but under the burden of memory. She had wanted to tell Kay something, and had forgotten him because of the story. She played with the fringe of her shawl. Not until a little while later did she look up, brush her eyes with her hand, and say, "This shawl comes from Clam. And the nightcap, too. The picture, the shawl, and the nightcap, those are my three mementos of him. I'm not young, like Frida. I'm not as ambitious as she, nor as sensitive. She's very sensitive. In short, I know how to adjust to life. But I must admit that without these three items, I wouldn't have lasted so long here. Indeed, I probably wouldn't have lasted a day. To you, these three mementos may seem trivial, but, you see, Frida, who consorted for so long with Clam, hasn't a single memento. I asked her. She's too effusive and too demanding. But I, who was only with Clam three times, later on he never sent for me again, I don't know why, as if sensing the shortness of my time there, I took these mementos along. Of course, one has to do it oneself. Clam himself never gives one anything. But if one sees anything suitable lying about, one can ask him for it." Kay felt uncomfortable about these stories, however much they concerned him. "How long ago was that?" he asked, sighing. "Over 20 years ago," said the landlady. "Well over 20 years ago."
"So one stays faithful to Clam that long," said Kay.
"Landlady, do you realize that you're causing me great concern when I think of my own future marriage?"
The landlady considered it unseemly that Kay wanted to barge in at this point with his own affairs, and gave him an irritated side glance.
"Not so angry, landlady," said Kay. "I'm certainly not saying a word against Clam, but through force of circumstances I have entered into certain relations with Clam. This is something not even Clam's greatest admirer could deny. And so, as a result, whenever Clam is mentioned, I must also think of myself. That cannot be helped. Besides, landlady," here Kay seized her hesitant hand, "remember the bad way our last conversation ended, and that this time we want to part in peace."
"You're right," the landlady said, bowing her head. "But spare me. I'm no more sensitive than anyone else. On the contrary, everybody has sensitive spots. I have only this one."
"Unfortunately, I have the same one," said Kay. "But I shall certainly restrain myself. Now, landlady, tell me how I should endure this dreadful fidelity to Clam in my own marriage, assuming Frida is like you in this respect."
"Dreadful fidelity,"
the landlady repeated sullenly.
"Well, is it fidelity? I'm faithful to my husband, but to Clam? Clam once made me his mistress. Can I ever lose that distinction? And you ask how you should endure this with Frida? Oh, surveyor, who are you to dare to ask such a thing?"
"Landlady," said Kay admonishingly.
"I know," said the landlady, yielding, "but my husband never asked questions like that. I don't know who should be considered more unfortunate, me then or Frida now. Frida, who wilfully left Clam, or me, whom he never sent for again. Perhaps it is after all Frida, though she does not yet seem to realize the full extent of this. My thoughts dwelt exclusively on my misfortune, though, for I had to ask myself, and indeed essentially still have to ask myself, why did it happen? 3 times Clam sent for you, but not a fourth time, never a fourth time. And what could have concerned me more then? What else could I talk about with my husband, whom I married shortly afterwards? By day we had no time. We acquired the inn in a miserable condition and had to try to bring it up to standard. But at night, for years our nighttime conversations circled around Clam and the reasons for his change of mind. And when my husband fell asleep during these conversations, I woke him up and we went on talking."
"Now, if you will permit me," said Kay, "I will ask you a rather rude question." The landlady remained silent. "So I may not ask," said Kay. "That's enough for me, too."
"Oh, of course," said the landlady. "That's enough for you, that especially. You misinterpret everything, even the silence. You simply cannot help it. I do give you permission to ask."
"If I'm misinterpreting everything," said Kay, "then perhaps I'm also misinterpreting my own question. Perhaps it isn't all that rude. I simply wanted to know how you met your husband and how this inn came into your hands." The landlady frowned, but said calmly, "It's a very simple story. My father was a blacksmith, and Hans, who is now my husband, and who was then a stable boy for a large farmer, often came to see my father.
This was just after my last encounter with Clam. I was very unhappy, and actually shouldn't have been, since everything followed the correct procedure, and the fact that I was no longer allowed to go to Clam was Clam's decision, so it was correct. But the reasons were obscure. I was allowed to probe those reasons, but shouldn't have been unhappy. Well, I was, all the same, and couldn't work, and sat in our little front garden all day. Hans saw me there, sometimes sat down with me. I never complained to him, but he knew what it was about, and, being a good lad, sometimes wept with me. And when the then landlord, whose wife had died, and who for that reason had to give up the trade, and anyhow he was already an old man, passed by our little garden and saw us sitting there, he stopped and on the spot offered to lease us the inn, and since he trusted us, he didn't want any money in advance and arranged cheap terms for the lease. I didn't want to become a burden to my father, and couldn't care about everything else, so thinking of the inn and all the new work which might make me forget a little, I gave Hans my hand. That's the story. For a little while there was silence. Then Kay said, "The landlord's conduct was fine, but imprudent, too. Or had he particular reasons for trusting you, too?"
"He knew Hans well," said the landlady. "He was Hans's uncle."
"Well, no wonder, then," said Kay. "So Hans's family was evidently very interested in the connection with you."
"Perhaps," said the landlady. "I don't know. I never worried about that."
"Still, that's how it must have been," said Kay. "If the family was ready to make such sacrifices and simply place the inn in your hands without any security."
"It wasn't imprudent, as became clear later," said the landlady. "I threw myself into the work. I was strong, a blacksmith's daughter. I didn't need a maid or a servant. I was everywhere, in the tap-room, in the kitchen, in the stables, in the courtyard. My cooking was so good I even drew guests from the gentleman's inn. You have not as yet been in the inn at noon. You don't know our luncheon guests. There were even more of them then. But in the meantime many have drifted away. And as a result we were not only able to pay the lease on time, but after a few years to buy the whole place, and now it's almost free of debt. The other result, though, was that I ruined myself, had heart problems, and now I am an old woman. You may think I'm much older than Hans, but actually he's only 2 or 3 years younger, and will never get any older for his work, smoking a pipe, listening to the guests, emptying his pipe, and getting a glass of beer every now and then. Such work doesn't make anyone older."
"Your achievements are admirable," said Kay. "No doubt about that. But we were talking about the time before your marriage, and at that time it would have been strange if Hans's family, under great financial sacrifice, or at least having taken on the great risk involved in giving up the inn, had actually pressed for marriage, for they could only put their hopes in your ability to work, which, of course, they didn't know anything about yet, and in Hans's, which, as they must already have discovered, was non-existent."
"Well, yes," the landlady said wearily. "I do know what you're getting at and how mistaken you are. There was no trace of Clam in all this. Why should he have cared about me? Or rather, how could he have cared about me? For by then he had forgotten all about me. That he hadn't called me was a sign he had forgotten me. Anyone whom he no longer summons, he forgets entirely. I didn't want to speak of this in front of Frida, but it isn't simply that he forgets. It's more than that. If you forget someone, you can, of course, get to know that person again. With Clam, that is not possible. Anyone whom he no longer summons, he forgets, not only for the past, but literally for all time. If I make an effort, I can even think my way into your thoughts, which make no sense here, but are perhaps valid in the foreign lands you come from. Perhaps you're so madly presumptuous as to think that Clam gave me a husband like Hans, so that almost nothing could prevent me from coming to him, should he ever call me in the future. Well, there could be nothing crazier than that. Where is the man who could prevent me from running to Clam if Clam gives me a sign? What nonsense, what utter nonsense! One merely makes oneself all confused by toying with such nonsense."
"No," said Kay. "We certainly don't want to make ourselves all confused. My thoughts hadn't gone as far as you think, but to tell the truth, they were heading in that direction. For the time being, though, I was merely surprised that the relatives had such high hopes for your marriage, and that these hopes were indeed realized, if at some risk to your heart, to your health. The thought that there was a connection between all this and Clam did occur to me, but not, or not yet, in the crude manner you implied, evidently only so you can shout at me again, for this clearly gives you pleasure. Well, have your pleasure. But these were my thoughts. First, Clam is obviously the cause of your marriage. Without Clam, you wouldn't have been unhappy,
wouldn't have sat idly in your little front garden. Without Clam, Hans wouldn't have seen you there. Without your sadness, the shy Hans would never have dared speak to you. Without Clam, you would never have found yourself in tears with Hans. Without Clam, your dear old uncle landlord wouldn't have seen Hans and yourself sitting there peacefully. Without Clam, you wouldn't have felt so indifferent about life, and so you wouldn't have married Hans. Well, that is surely enough Clam, I should say. But there is more. If you hadn't been trying to forget, you certainly wouldn't have worked so recklessly and brought the inn up to such a high standard. So there's also some Clam there. But even leaving that aside, Clam is the cause of your illness, since even before your marriage your heart was drained by that unfortunate passion. The only question left is why Hans's relatives found the marriage so appealing. You yourself once mentioned that being Clam's mistress is an increase in stature that cannot be lost, so perhaps that is what attracted them. But I believe they were also hoping that the lucky star which led you to Clam, assuming it was indeed a lucky star, but you claim it was, belonged to you and would remain yours and would not, say, abandon you as quickly or as suddenly as Clam did.
"Do you mean all of this seriously?" asked the landlady.
"Very seriously," said Kay quickly. "Only I think that the hopes of Hans's relatives were neither completely justified nor completely unjustified, and I also think I recognize the mistake you've made. Outwardly, everything does seem to have worked out. Hans is well provided for, has an imposing wife, enjoys great esteem, the inn is free of debt. But everything didn't actually work out. With a simple girl whose first great love he would have been, Hans would certainly have been far happier. If he sometimes stands about the inn as if lost, as you chide him for doing, that's because he truly does feel lost. Not that this makes him unhappy, that's for sure. I know him well enough by now to be able to say so. But it's equally certain that this handsome, sensible lad would have been happier with another wife, and by happier I mean more independent, more diligent, and more manly. And after all, you yourself certainly aren't happy, and as you yourself said, without those three mementos you wouldn't want to go on living, and you also have a weak heart. So was it wrong of his relatives to hope? I don't think so. There were blessings above you, but nobody knew how to get them down."
"And what was it we failed to do?" asked the landlady.
She was now lying stretched out on her back, gazing up at the ceiling.
"Ask Clam," said Kay. "So we're back to you," said the landlady.
"Or to you," said Kay. "Our concerns overlap."
"So what do you want from Clam?" said the landlady.
She had sat up straight, shaken out the pillows so she could lean on them as she sat, and now looked Kay directly in the eye.
"I've told you openly about my own case, which you could learn something from. Tell me just as openly what you want to ask Clam. I had difficulty persuading Frieda to go to her room and stay there. I was afraid you wouldn't speak openly enough with her here."
"I have nothing to hide," said Kay. "But first I must point out one thing. Clam forgets at once, you said. Well, first, I find that highly improbable. And second, it cannot be proved. It's obviously nothing but a legend, concocted in the girlish minds of those who just happen to be in Clam's good graces. I'm surprised you believe in such a trite fabrication."
"It is not a legend," said the landlady, "but comes from general experience."
"So it can be refuted by new experiences," said Kay. "But then there is one other difference between your case and Frieda's. As for Clam's not having called Frieda again, in a sense no such thing happened. He called her, but she didn't comply. It's even possible he's still waiting for her." The landlady remained silent, merely observing Kay from head to toe. Then she said,
"I want to listen quietly to all you have to say. It's better if you speak openly and don't spare my feelings. I have only one request. Do not use Clam's name. Call him he or something else, but not by his name."
"Gladly," said Kay. "But it's difficult to say what I want from him. First I want to see him close up. Then I want to hear his voice. Then I want him to tell me where he stands concerning our marriage. Whatever other requests I make will depend on how the conversation goes. A number of subjects may come up, but for me the most important thing is simply to be standing there opposite him. I have not yet spoken directly to a real official, you see. That seems harder to achieve than I had thought. But now I have an obligation to speak with Clam, the private individual, and to my mind that is much easier to accomplish. I can only speak with the official in his perhaps inaccessible office at the castle, or, and this is already quite dubious, at the gentleman's inn. But I can speak with the private individual at the inn, on the street, anywhere I manage to meet him. The chance of having the official face to face as well is something I shall gladly accept, but that isn't my primary goal."
"Fine,"
said the landlady, pressing her face into the pillows as if she were saying something shameful.
"If I succeed through my connections in getting your request for a conversation forwarded to Clam, promise me you won't try anything on your own initiative until an answer comes down."
"That I cannot promise," said Kay, "much as I would like to grant your request, or whim. This is urgent, you see, especially after the unfavourable outcome of my meeting with the chairman."
"Well, that objection isn't applicable," said the landlady. "The chairman is utterly insignificant."
"So you never noticed? He wouldn't last a day in his position were it not for his wife, who runs everything."
"Mitzi?" asked Kay.
The landlady nodded.
"Well, she was there," said Kay. "Did she express an opinion?" asked the landlady.
"Well, no," said Kay, "but I did not get the impression that she was capable of that."
"Well, that's it," said the landlady. "That's how wrongly you view everything here. Besides, the chairman's decision concerning you has no significance, and I shall certainly speak with his wife at some point. And if I now promise you that Clam's reply will arrive a week from now at the latest, then you will surely not keep on coming up with new reasons for not giving in to me."
"Well, none of that is decisive," said Kay. "My decision stands, and I would try to carry it out even if the answer that arrived were negative. But since this has been my intention from the start, I obviously cannot request an interview in advance. What remains in the absence of that request, a daring but well-meant venture, would, after an adverse answer, be open rebellion. And that, of course, would be far worse."
"Worse," said the landlady. "It's rebelliousness anyhow. And now do as you like. Hand me my skirt."
Showing no consideration for Kay, she pulled on her skirt and hurried to the kitchen. For some time now, a commotion had been audible from the parlour. Someone was knocking on the spy window. The assistants had at one point opened it and shouted in that they were hungry. Other faces had appeared there too. Even a song, faint but in several parts, could be heard. Kay's conversation with the landlady had naturally very much delayed the cooking of lunch. It was not yet ready, but the guests were assembled. Still, nobody had dared to defy the landlady's prohibition by entering the kitchen. But now, when the observers at the spy window announced that the landlady was coming, the maids immediately ran into the kitchen. And when Kay entered the parlour, an amazingly large company, more than 20 men and women, dressed provincially, though not like peasants, poured from the spy window where they had gathered to the tables in order to secure places for themselves. Only at one small table in the corner was a couple already seated with several children. The man, a friendly blue-eyed gentleman with tousled grey hair and a beard, was bending down to the children and beating time with a knife for their song, which he kept trying to quiet down. Perhaps he wanted to make them forget their hunger by getting them to sing. The landlady excused herself before the company with a few casually spoken words. Nobody reproached her for this. She looked around for the landlord, who had surely fled the difficult situation some time ago. Then she went slowly into the kitchen. For Kay, who was hurrying to Frida in his room, she hadn't a glance to spare. Chapter 7. The Teacher. Upstairs, Kay met the teacher. The room was fortunately almost unrecognizable, so diligent had Frida been. It had been given a good airing, the stove was lit, the floor had been scrubbed, the bed straightened out, the maids' things, all that disgusting rubbish, including their pictures, had vanished, and the table, which used to stare at you with its dirt-encrusted top no matter which way you turned, had been covered with a crocheted white cloth. Now you could receive guests. That Kay's small batch of laundry, which Frida had obviously washed this morning, hung by the stove to dry, barely spoiled the effect. The teacher and Frida had been sitting at the table. They rose as Kay entered. Frida greeted Kay with a kiss. The teacher bowed slightly. Kay, still distracted and uneasy after the conversation with the landlady, began to excuse himself for not having visited the teacher. It was as if he assumed that the teacher had become impatient over his failure to appear and had now called on him instead. In his measured way, the teacher seemed only gradually to recall that he and Kay had once spoken about a possible visit.
"Surveyor," he said slowly, "you are indeed the stranger I spoke to in the church square a few days ago."
"Yes," said Kay curtly. The sort of thing he had put up with earlier in his isolation, he no longer had to tolerate in his own room. He turned to Frida and mentioned an important visit he had to make at once and needed to be as well dressed as possible for. Immediately, without asking for an explanation, Frida called the assistants, who were busy inspecting the new tablecloth, and ordered them down to the courtyard to clean with great care Kay's clothes and shoes, which he had already begun to remove. She herself took a shirt from the line and ran down to the kitchen to iron it.
Now Kay was alone with the teacher, who again sat at the table in silence. Kay made him wait a little longer, took off his shirt and began to wash at the basin. Only then, with his back to the teacher, did Kay ask why he had come.
"I have come on instructions from the chairman," he said.
Kay was prepared to listen to the instructions, but since Kay's words were difficult to understand with all the splashing, the teacher had to come closer, and he leaned against the wall next to Kay. Kay excused his washing and his agitation by mentioning the urgency of the planned visit. Ignoring this, the teacher said, "You were impolite to the council chairman, that worthy, experienced and venerable old man."
"I'm not aware of having been impolite," said Kay, drying himself, "though you're quite right that I have more important things to worry about than fancy manners, for what was at stake was my livelihood, which has been jeopardized by the ignominious machinations of officialdom, the details of which I needn't fill you in on, since you yourself are an active part of that official apparatus. Has the council chairman ever complained about me?"
"Whom do you think he could complain to?" said the teacher. "And even if there were such a person, do you think he would ever complain? I simply took down from his dictation a short deposition concerning that meeting, and this has given me insight into the kindness of the chairman and the quality of your answers." As Kay looked for his comb, which Frieda must have tidied away somewhere, he said, "What? A deposition? Taken down afterwards in my absence by someone who wasn't even present at the meeting? Not bad at all. But why a deposition? Was it official business?"
"No," said the teacher, "it was semi-official. The deposition itself is only semi-official, and was only drawn up because everything must be kept strictly in order here. Anyhow, it's finished and reflects badly on your honour."
Kay, who had finally found the comb, which had slipped between the covers of the bed, said more calmly, "Well then, let it be finished. And you've come here to inform me of that?"
"No," said the teacher, "but I'm not an automaton and had to tell you what I think. The chairman's instructions, on the other hand, offer further proof of his kindness. I would like to stress that I find his kindness incomprehensible, and am carrying out his instructions only as an official duty and out of respect for the chairman."
Washed and combed, Kay sat at the table waiting for his shirt and clothes. He had little interest in the message the teacher had brought. Besides, he was influenced by the landlady's low opinion of the chairman. "It must already be past 12," he asked, thinking of the way he wanted to go. But then, on second thoughts, he added, "You were about to give me some message from the chairman."
"Oh, yes," the teacher said with a shrug, as though shaking off all responsibility.
"The chairman fears that if the decision in your case takes too long, you will take the initiative and do something rash. As for me, I don't know why he fears that, for to my mind it would be best if you did as you pleased. We are not your guardian angels and don't have to follow you down every single byway." "Well, all right, the chairman thinks differently. Of course, the actual decision, which is handled by the Count's authorities, is not something he can speed up. But within his sphere of influence, he seems to want to arrive at a truly generous temporary settlement, which you are free to accept or to reject. He is offering you temporarily the post of school janitor." At first, Kay almost ignored the offer he had been made, but the very fact of his being offered something was, it seemed to him, not without significance. It showed that the chairman thought him capable of carrying out acts in his own defence that would even justify certain expenses by the community so as to protect itself. And how seriously they were taking the whole thing. The teacher, who had already been waiting here a while and had prepared the deposition beforehand, must have been literally chased over by the chairman. When the teacher saw that he had finally made Kay stop and reflect, he went on, "I stated my objections. I pointed out that we had managed without a school janitor up to now. The wife of the sexton tidies up now and then, and her work is supervised by the schoolmistress, Miss Giza. I already have enough torment with the children. I don't want the added bother of a janitor." The chairman countered that the schoolhouse was actually very dirty. I replied, truthfully, that it wasn't so bad. "And besides," I added, "would things get any better if we took that man on as janitor?" "Certainly not. Quite apart from his ignorance of that kind of work, the schoolhouse has only two large classrooms, without any small adjoining rooms, so the janitor and his family must live, sleep, and perhaps even cook in one of the classrooms, and of course this will hardly enhance the general cleanliness. The chairman, though, declared that the position would assist you in time of need, and that you would therefore discharge your duties well, with great energy. Besides, the chairman said that we would, in addition to you, gain the services of your wife and assistants, and that the school and the garden, too, could be kept in impeccable condition." I rebutted all this easily.
Finally, the chairman, unable to come up with anything else in your favour, laughed and said that you were a surveyor, so you should be able to lay out marvellously straight flower beds. Well, there's no point objecting to a joke, so I brought you the message.
Teacher, you needn't worry about that, said Kay. I would not even consider accepting the post.
Splendid, said the teacher. Splendid, you decline, and unconditionally at that. And picking up his hat, he bowed and left. Immediately thereafter, Frida came up. Her face was distraught. She still hadn't ironed the shirt she was carrying and did not respond to questions. In order to distract her a little, Kay told her about the teacher and his offer. No sooner had she heard it than she threw the shirt on the bed and ran off again. She was soon back, though this time with the teacher, who looked annoyed and didn't even greet Kay. Frida asked him to be patient for a while. She had obviously done so several times on the way here, then pulled Kay through a side door he hadn't noticed into the neighbouring attic, where, excited and breathless, she finally told him what had happened. The landlady, incensed at having humiliated herself by making certain confessions to Kay, and, worse still, at having given way over an interview between Clam and Kay, for she had gained nothing, so she said, but a cold and what's more insincere rebuff, was determined not to tolerate Kay's presence in her house any longer. If he had any connections with the castle, then he should take advantage of them right away, for he must leave the inn today, this instant, and she would take him back only if expressly ordered or compelled to do so by the authorities. But she hoped this would never happen, for she too had connections with the castle and would know how to make use of them. Incidentally, he had been admitted to the inn only through the negligence of the landlord. Besides, he was in no real need, for even this morning he had boasted about other lodgings that were available to him. Of course, Frida should stay. If Frida moved out with Kay, she, the landlady, would be deeply unhappy. She, a poor woman with a weak heart, had already collapsed in tears downstairs by the stove in the kitchen at the mere thought of it. But how could she respond any differently? For at least in her opinion, the honour of Clam's memory was at stake. That's how the landlady feels. Frida would certainly follow him, Kay, wherever he wanted to go, in the snow and ice, and no more need be said on that score. Anyhow, the situation was quite serious for both of them, which is why she had responded with such enthusiasm to the chairman's offer. Even if the post was unsuitable for Kay, it was, after all, and the chairman had singled this out for special emphasis, only a temporary one, and in that way they could gain some time and easily find other opportunities, even if the final decision proved unfavourable.
"And if need be," cried Frida, who had already put her arms round Kay's neck, "we shall go abroad. What keeps us here in the village? Temporarily, though, we accept the offer, don't we, dearest? I've brought the teacher back. You just have to say agreed, that's all, and then we'll move into the schoolhouse."
"That's terrible," said Kay, though without really meaning it seriously, for their housing was of little concern to him. Besides, he was freezing in his underwear here in the attic, which, lacking both wall and window on two sides, was swept by a cold, sharp wind. "Now that you've done up the room so beautifully, we're supposed to move out. I have little desire, very little desire, to take on the post. That one brief moment of humiliation in front of this little teacher is already embarrassing enough, and now he's even supposed to be my superior. If only we could stay a little longer, my situation might well change by this afternoon. Or at least, if you stayed here on your own, we could wait and simply give the teacher some vague answer. I can always find a night's lodging, if need be, at but—" With her hand, Frida sealed his lips.
"Don't," she said anxiously. "Please don't say that again. But otherwise I'll do everything you want. If you want, I'll stay here alone, though that would make me sad. If you want, we'll reject the offer. But I think that would be wrong. For look, if you actually find another opportunity for us, possibly even this afternoon, we'll immediately give up the post in the school. Nobody will try to stop us. And as for your being humiliated in front of the teacher, I'll make sure that doesn't happen. I'll speak to him. You need only be present. You don't have to say a word. And it will always be this way. You will never have to speak to him yourself, unless you want to. Indeed, I'm the only one who will be his subordinate, and even I shall be no such thing, for I know his weaknesses. And therefore we won't lose anything if we accept the post, but a great deal if we turn it down. Above all else, if you don't get anything from the castle today, you will certainly never find any lodgings here in the village, even for you alone, or lodgings that I, as your future wife, wouldn't have to feel ashamed of. And then, when you fail to find lodgings, I suppose you'll even expect me to sleep here in this warm room, knowing that you're outside, wandering about in the dark and cold."
Kay, who had crossed his arms on his chest and was slapping himself on the back in an effort to warm up a little, said, "Then we have no choice but to accept. Come." Once in the room, he rushed straight to the stove, ignoring the teacher. The latter, who was seated at the table, pulled out his watch and said, "It's gotten late."
"Yes, teacher.
But the two of us agree now, said Frida. We accept the post.
Fine, said the teacher. But the post was offered to the surveyor. He has to say what he thinks.
Frida helped Kay out.
Of course, she said. He accepts the post. Don't you, Kay?
Kay could therefore confine himself to a simple yes that was addressed not to the teacher, but to Frida.
Well then, said the teacher, all I have to do now is point out your official duties. That way we will have agreed upon this once and for all. Surveyor, you must clean and heat both schoolrooms on a daily basis, assume responsibility for all minor repairs to the building, as well as to the school and gymnastic equipment, keep the garden path clear of snow, run messages for myself and the schoolmistress, and in the milder seasons do all the gardening. In exchange, you may live in whichever schoolroom you choose. If the two rooms are not both being used simultaneously for instruction, and you happen to live in a room in which instruction is to take place, you must, of course, move into the other room. You may not cook in the schoolhouse, but in return you and your dependents will receive free board at the inn at the community's expense. That your conduct must remain in keeping with the dignity of the school, and that the children especially must not witness any disagreeable domestic scenes, particularly during class, I mention only in passing, for this is of course something that you, an educated person, must already know. In this regard, I would also point out that we must insist that you legalize your relations with Miss Frida as soon as possible. To cover these issues and a few other minor points, there will be an employment contract, which you must sign on moving into the schoolhouse. All this seemed unimportant to Kay, as if it didn't apply to him, or at least weren't binding on him. But annoyed by the teacher's self-importance, he said casually, "Oh yes, simply the usual commitments." In an effort to cover up that comment, Frida inquired about the salary. "The payment of a salary," said the teacher, "will only be considered after a one-month probationary period."
"But that will make it hard for us," said Frida. "We are supposed to get married on almost no money and set up a household with nothing. Teacher, couldn't we petition the council for a small salary right away? Would you recommend this?"
"No," said the teacher, addressing his remarks, as always, to Kay alone. "Such a petition would be approved only if I recommended it, and I would not do so. You're being awarded this post as a favour, and if one remains conscious of one's official responsibilities, one shouldn't push such favours too far." Now, however, Kay broke in, almost against his will. "Teacher, as far as the favour goes," he said, "I believe you are mistaken. The favour may be more on my side."
"No," said the teacher, smiling, now that he had actually forced Kay to speak.
This book is continued on Disc 4.